Yeah, well. Good evening, friends of poetry. Before we begin, I've been asked to make an announcement on behalf of the St. Louis Arts and Humanities Commission. The St. Louis Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts will sponsor a 1.5-day conference at the St. Louis University School of Law on Friday and Saturday, March 12th and 13th. The conference includes a special session on contract law as it relates to the field of publishing and the literary arts. And that gets more important by the day, since it's hard enough to scratch up and we want to keep as much as we can. There are brochures available from, do you have brochures there? From Zia Gibson, who is the program director. And if anyone's interested in further information, sometime during the break, you can pump Zia. I've never pumped her, but I imagine it would be fun. St. Louis area attorneys and accountants will be the presenters at this meeting. And now, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce a man who's been a close friend of mine for more years than either of us like to remember. John Nofel came into a small office that I was hibernating in at St. Louis University back in the late 50s. And he had been referred to me by our common friend John Logan. Since that time, his journeying has been extensive. He gives readings at campuses and public auditoriums, large and small. You will hear what he has to say for himself, but I know of no man who has something to, who has more to say for us now, because I think his abiding and overriding interest has always been justice, but justice as it can be translated in terms of how we deal with each other, and particularly with those who are not as fortunate as we might happen to be. What he has to say is far more compelling, challenging, and exciting than anything that I could tell you about him. So I just want to say with great pleasure that I'm proud to introduce to you right now a man I consider one of the finest poets in the country, John Nofel.
Maybe we should do some Missouri things tonight, huh? This little one called Flight to Springfield, Missouri. Not so many flying, the old man, the oldest thing in the sky. Heavy smoker, lively and 80, says we don't think like they did. The Republic meant something different to them. We land at Leonard Wood, the runway ripped from the hills like the tongue from the jaws of a buffalo. The old man looks at the edge of the forest and dreams. Now, while I'm rooting through here looking for the poems I want, I'd like to tell you about my fellow townie in Auburn, Illinois, whose name is Henry Allison Rollins Dim. We call him Hardy. He's a master of proverbs. He writes things like, the man who holds the basket the longest catches the leaf. I'll give you some more of those as the evening goes on. This is a set of five poems called From a Missouri Land Grant. And the first one is a generalized Ozark Spring poem, and then Johnson Shut-ins, Elephant Rocks, Fisher Cave, and Salt Lick. That's up in northern part of the state. They're kind of nature poems. But I thought you'd all like them, being from the area. Ozark Spring. Blue coin of earth, generous in that green hickory light, shafting through elm and the smell of cedars, clinging and faint in a rocky soil under old mountains, hills worn down with so many seas. Water swelling from the cliff base, deep blue, blue, silky, flowing shallow over pebbles, a clear channel, light green, dark green, crest bannering tan stones and dots of small black snails grown used to the sheer chill of the stream. Quiet, too, with lily and lotus, and back in the deep hole of the spring, place of half-visible rock shelving the eye down to deeper blue, trout hanging indolent, sustained there, beyond our beginnings. This is Shut-ins. East fork through the ridged porphyry, cutting the igneous stone purple and polished on the spurs of the side trail, narrow over the river, we climb down working through rapids, the wet rocks slippery, small falls catching us helpless into pools, laughing although you sense deep openings in crevices and terror a little. It is easier at the foot of high gray cliffs, a larger pool slowing green water, where you can dive or leap 35 feet from steep ledges or watch others do that, and sicken with the thudding the body makes hurled onto a surface. You tense when a boy dives, waiting his shot upward from surges of white foam, face all smiles for the manhood in it. Lazy, then, you climb up current, goat-footing cracked boulders, and choose one to rest on, shut in sunlight and grateful. We picnic in a grove shady with cedar, the ground in park grass and flinty at the gullies. I find a knife, blue chert chipped with a master's care, a meticulous hand, and then a cruder point, old and shaped lanceolate from 7,000 years. A hunter's work who knew the mid-continent in gales of dust, come here with his women, his kinsmen maybe, everyone to climb rocks and falls, all watching one another, solemn birds or sleepy animals of flashing white teeth in brown human faces, with a sparkle of water, shimmering tits and thighs for the joy in it. Life so short then, before the women were spent, and the pain of that arthritic wilderness crippled those hunting hands. He must have loved this place. These are the Elephant Rocks. Lower ranges, stones heavy at the edge of the valley, grinders for rending time into powders, we cross pile on pile of the red stones squeezing through, deceived, the stones looming larger as we come west to the edge, place of stunted oak and dry scale on the stones like coppered weathered. Nothing moves, seems to have ever moved, Even the names of the quarrymen appear to be chiseled forever. Fingers in the palm of your hand rough out the boulders, pitted and windswept, scarred by ancient waters. And the heart forgets the rhythm of its own beating, and the body comes to its own coil in the rock for a while. And then you go back, stone underfoot, scattering into dust, a littered trail. And the vision dies in a gleam of chrome and cars. You notice it is a hot day, and time has you again, but not quite again. That one was written before they changed and made it a better park. So you came to the rocks from the back. This is Fisher Cave, and there's a sunken story in it about Jonah. Remember, he was supposed to go to Nineveh, but he didn't like the idea. So he tried to take ship to Joppa, and he was then, cast overboard when the storm was raised up. And he was caught by the whale and disgorged on the shore. And so he got the message and went to Nineveh, and he told the king and everybody it was going to be a hot time for them if they didn't shape up. And much to his dismay, they did. They all put on sackcloth and ashes, so God had compassion on the Ninevites, and it made a fool out of Jonah. So he got mad and went out and sulked in the sun. So Yahweh raised a vine over him to shade him, and he liked that. And then Yahweh killed the vine, and he was mad again. So sort of like all of us. Fisher Cave. Caving, going down into the earth, cool there with our Jonah shadows, apprehensive, seeing what has been hidden, waiting for our coming, shadows filling chambers, riches of onyx and clay for the potter's wheel, broken splendors, and our messages, whatever we carry for someone who will listen to us if he hears us. Where have we come from, the hot day, all our lives to this station, subdued in corridors, the lost rivers of the world have etched under the earth? We return, wearing our chill like a sleeve, the air hazing at the cave's mouth, and come to ourselves again, not knowing to what purpose, kings throwing dust in their hair, our sulking, perhaps, under vines in the punishing sun. Now, this is the salt lick, and Boone is said to have made the spring box there. It is sullen here. The mud flat will not bear life, where the saline springs flecked with silver widen into rivers that will absorb them. Boone made this spring box. I look into the water shaped with his hands and stare with his eyes at the suppressed continents of the earth. The mud captures each leaf. The prints of the raccoons seem held now for years that will number in the thousands. All right. Let's do a St. Louis poem about the resurrection of the dead. Here is another one ready to celebrate All Hallows Eve, an anonymous old man who starved in St. Louis a long time ago, perhaps a slave in a limestone cell or an Irish roustabout on the landing. He is restive in his box, heart beating rudely in the black cavern under his ribs, his white old skull grinning, as of course they all do, from the shudder of the heart that sets the bones vibrating. He is stirred up all right, his tubular arms extending, pushing out the lid of the coffin against the St. Louis sundown, sun going down like that same old man descending into a steam bath once. And now his wrist bones force the cover back on the evening. Stars slide down the lid as his universe expands. They go down as he comes up. That's called Heads Up, Another One Rising. Now, you're a very wonderful audience, so I'll read you a folk poem called The Farmer and the Owl. And this is based on a story a fellow told me. He said when he was a boy, he caught a hawk and threw gasoline on it and lit it up. And it flew into his father's barn and burnt it down. So that's poetic justice. And I wrote the poem that way and lost it, and then turned it up a few years later and looked at it and said, the farmer should have the last word. So I added two lines. I have to understand this is an educated owl. He knows Empedocles, the philosopher who leaped into Mount Etna saying, here I go, and heals to the last of me. And he's read his revelations. I will dramatize the voices so you'll know which one is the farmer and which one is the owl. Farmer said to this owl he caught, okay, you skinny prophet, let's see how you light up the dark. There's your tail feathers diddled in kerosene and struck to hell's fire with my match. Owl fussed and flared in the yard, screeched, hoo, 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 hoo. Oh, God of all owls, stiffen my bones with manganese. And you, you son of a Kansas fathead, bawl out loud when you see my revelations. Here I go, and haylofts to the last of me. Oh, my virginal owl soul. May you rise with a pure blue flame from the ashes of this barn tonight. Farmer watched his barn burn down. Bird shit, he said. Bird shit. Dirty, pious bird shit. Bird shit. There's a little poem about Fort Chartres on the other side of the river below Chester, Illinois. It's called Outpost on the Mississippi. As you know, that was a French fort. The French commander addressed the Indian villagers. He was about 4'5". He told them, I have a little body, but my heart is big enough for everyone. The Indians believed him. They are all gone into time now, the commander, the French soldiers, the Indians. The afternoon is hazy. Tourists wander the park. A family walks a balance on the stone foundation of the commissary. A man and a woman blow alternately on their picnic fire. The planet is rolling slowly to accommodate the scene. He says, do you believe me? I say the whole nation wants to believe you. Try after gray days. I understand that in China, the word for America also means land of a thousand flowers. After gray days. Nobody knows what to do. You take pills, get the word from television, eat right food. You wander around an afternoon. When it's raining, your blood wants you to whittle, but that isn't done now. Then someone comes up on the porch with his hair beating water and rain dripping off his nose. He says that the Chinese think of America as that far country of a thousand flowers. You smile at him suddenly. You think if you could only release maybe 50 million balloons over Asia saying, good luck to you, China, from the land of a thousand flowers, some golden years might pour down time. You peer through store windows watching the shoplifters. You think, why are we all thieves in our bandages? And the snakes in the rocks hissing come, crush our heads, flay us, hang our long skins. on the screen doors of your houses. State of the Union message. Fellow Americans, white water lilies drop roots into muck. If we stop this muck, we will kill our water lilies. Just a few more here, maybe. Do Four Winds over St. Louis. Now, you've all suffered through the summer. You know the wind out of the southwest, and you know the wind out of the south, and the wonderful wind out of the north, and the hideous wind out of the east. Well, that's what these poems are about. It's kind of strange. It's kind of hard to do this because you've got all kinds of things blending in here that are really not good bedfellows, but they work somehow, maybe. This is West Wind. A month of straw burning your lungs, a cotton bowl weaveling your lungs, whining in the dry maples, voices of presidents, the righteous surety of millionaires, piss of the poor white and Chicano, coyotes squashed on the interstate, purgatorial for the sin of greed, and you dam all wagons west, and cattle heaving toward Abilene, no-account cowpokes flaring blue lightning in their beards, oil heat in 100 degrees, flaming off the panhandle, cracking the bone gates of your mothers. South Wind. Rich mouth, tracheal air, dripping Louisiana booby princes come a-loving you like a warm, sweet milk, and she like Deirdre on her stone judgment seat with her toes curled in swamp muck, thumbing down some poor Jake you couldn't tell for black or white, crying, "See how he looked at me? Y'all gouge out his eyes, you hear? And that one wriggling for my poor body cut off his balls, y'all. Sweet, lovely, pressing you down with pussycat stocks and bonds from plaque mine, oh, treacherous, mouthing her eros for your bad, lonesome sundowns, and you on parole telling the cop this starry-handled sliver of moonlight just stuck here in your hand like shoe-fly pie. Oh, you long-legged, lean, smothering beauty, you'd let a man nibble those perfumed trinkets in your ears and hang in your noose half-dead forever." North Wind. Blue up there and open still when that cold Canada comes glancing fifes and drums from the Arctic. The eye marks fleece in columns, and time withers like an old tit. We get on with new business. Everybody has two birds in his hand. You can shrill hosannas, losing your pants, or come free of a steaming earth with a whistle and a belly full of psalms. East Wind. Plague of frogs, spawned in the Chesapeake, boronking, boronking, lying cool and plausible in a slithering death, gagging us like a fungus on the river, saying, "S'all right," where a horn blows in a black hot night in an empty lot in East St. Louis, and no angels answer that horn, splitting the wind. Well, Pilgrim's Day. Mother told the man at the door, "You get your ass out of here," and he ran with his chrysanthemum bobbing upside down in his lapel. We were all amazed. The stuffing we gobbled hung on our forks in the afternoon, old recollections of Providence at anchor in our blood, until Beth, my sister, with her pansy eyes, said it was truth that our mother drove away from the door. "Truth hell," cried Mother, smoothing her skirt, "that was your father." and our mouths drooped into O's while we searched the bland face at the head of the table. Then Beth, with the streaks in her eyes, said, "Who is it carved us the turkey today?" "Truth," shouted our mother. "Now all of you eat." And she clamped her mouth shut on a bun. The lover falls in the meadow, has no plans for cultivation. Now, my friend Dim, get this one. Suck an egg today, scramble one tomorrow. The best nails have average heads. This is a poem about one of the playoff games. I forget when it was. Somebody played Texas. Dallas, that is. And I was in the study, and I came out just when my son, who was little, he wasn't even a teenager yet, but he turned on television, and the face of Howard Cosell bloomed on the set. And he was saying, "When I think of Coach Lombardi, I think of Armageddons and Pantheons." And I said, "John, I'm going to give you some fatherly advice. You've got to recognize bullshit when you see it." Well, anyway, I had been looking at Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and you remember the pictures of the Oglala in this Dead in the Snow are in that book. And what else happened? They had big time at the half, and those horrible Texas Rangerettes did a bottoms up. And they had a goodbye for Armstrong. Carol Channing sang "When the Saints Go Marching In." And what else? Remember, President Nixon sang in a play. It didn't work. And that's the truth. It flopped the whole thing. So I think it was an end run or something. But anyway, then that night we were watching the, on public television, the sequence, The Wives of Henry VIII, and that night was lovely Jane Seymour. Anyway, this is the poem. I was looking at Bigfoot's picture. He wanted to ask us something, his Oglala body a question mark clenched in the snow. And this face on TV is an old pro coach. They talk about their eyes raining Pantheons and Armageddons. And the Texas rose is blowing with joy, that joy so wild in Dallas, and everybody wanting somebody to win a great day. And 70 upturned feminine bottoms, pretty as peaches on a picnic table. And his goodbye old satch, he is gone, marching with his old done-in saints. However, just a few blacks there, I suppose, looking for some others. And I tell my son, "Young fellow, the car engine is racing, the temperature is getting out of hand. Go forth and shut off the ignition. This is his moment to do this." His smile breaks the horizon, his eyes scatter the morning stars. I write JK plus MK on the kitchen window, my arrow shot through a steamy heart. He laughs, rubs it all out. Why, what if his friend saw what his father wrote? And there were jets and drums and anthems, and the president blessing a play that did not work because Texas would have its undeniable joy. And that night I watched Plain Jane, the king's true wife, who died in her child's birth. This poem on the birthday of Dr. King. It needs some explanation. I was reading for an essay on the literature of the broad Midwest, and I had read some of the Pawnee tales recorded by Grinnell. One of them is about a bull buffalo that escorts a boy out of a snowstorm. And I had been reading Henry Adams' Log of a Cowboy. They took a herd up the Circle Dots from Mexico all the way into Montana because the Blackfeet were starving at that time. And there's one other reference there, Marie Sandoz's Winter Thunder, one of the terrible blizzards hit out there, and a school teacher kept a group of children alive for a whole week when it was 38 below. There's a reference to St. Hilary's Day. It falls on the same day as King's birthday. He was an exiled bishop, must have been a pretty good one. And a reference to Dan Berrigan. He was on trial and fell sick in jail. I think that's about all we need for that. Four above, chill factor out, 14 below, children in and out. Dog sitting on the front porch thinks her tail will drop off if she wags it. Cold on the floorboards of the house, wife uptight at the ironing board, kids drafty home from school, King's Day. Strange Philadelphia hard hat singing Dixie when he died, black friend saying he spoke white. High reading teacher saves nine children caught in a blizzard 38 below. 50 inches of snow, eight dead calf they found had a few matches. Wind whipped weak before they were found. And here a cattle drive 400 circle dots cross North Platte near old Fort Laramie. Pretty sight. And here a boy lost, bull buffalo, finds him in snowstorm, tells him how the father sent him, trots alongside, sings him a Pawnee song. Can't remember the news, very strange, Dan Berrigan gone sick in jail, St. Hilary's Day, 4th century bishop exiled, and king had to have it make even his enemies look good, had those terms could melt ice in the heart of a stone, if there was a stone. So, maybe I'll close with one poem a little more recent. As you know, I guess I live in Auburn, Illinois, which is a town of 3,000, some 15 miles southwest of Springfield, Illinois. And our most famous citizen is Dutch Leonard. Some of you may know that he perfected the knuckleball. So much for my hometown there. Anyway, I was up in Springfield one Sunday in Vachel Lindsay's house, and there was a little reception and a concert there. And that house is full of presences, not only Vachel, because he would scribble his poems on the walls and whatnot, and the house was kept much as he left it. It's not an American Heritage house at all. But the house was also owned by Mary Todd Lincoln's sister. And he spent his last night in Springfield in that house. Well, as you know, Lindsay had a difficult life and ended it finally with a brutal suicide. Well, let's see what happens here. Lindsay's house on a cold Sunday afternoon in Springfield, table laid with his service, reception, sweet punch and cookies. He did not indulge, I am disappointed, my ankles freezing. But the recorder trio seems impervious to the cold. They warm to their Renaissance concert. They play an unnamed song by King Henry VIII, and it is beautiful. This house has so many histories. Lindsay, his birth and death here. Lincoln, his sister-in-law's house. His last night in Springfield here. Poems and political memories. So much hope in these rooms. Release from the fictions of our terror. Snow, a few flakes outside the window. Fireplace needs a damper or a screen. Henry VIII this afternoon, sovereign of a clutch of talent, life botched a royal Falstaff, model for the frivolous, his crude power that took down, it seems, only the best of men. And now his song, lovely and a surprise. Rachel, we don't know what to do with our lives. How fill them up? How even not to be self-conscious? Our success is squeezed from us despite our failings, and yet there are some like figures on a cave wall made there for the days to come, all the days. And when we find them, they teach us, and we change. Thank you.